Well, this is quite an event and quite a lot of fun for me. For all practical purposes, The Recognition is a novel I grew up with. Published in 1955 by Harcourt Brace when I was 13, in an edition littered with typographical errors, it did not receive particularly good or incisive press or wide distribution. I read about it because I was an obsessive reader of book reviews back then. But the first time I was really aware of it was 3 or 4 years later, when my older cousin, Barbara, who was in medical school, had a red-headed boyfriend named Fradley, a young man who lived in a Greenwich Village apartment at the other end of the hall from a writer. One evening, Barbara, then in her middle 20s, and her rambunctious teenaged cousin, Chip, were at Fradley's apartment in the West Village, and I noticed on Fradley's desk was a very thick book. On the back cover was a praiseful endorsement from the British poet Robert Graves, some of whose poems I'd read, comparing the book favorably to Eliot's Wasteland, which I'd also read. The month before, I had read an entire book by Graves, The White Goddess, a poor man's or bright adolescent's golden bough. Indeed, the book had made the rounds of some 3/4 of our junior high school creative writing class. Fradley said something to the effect that the book had been given to him by its author, his down-the-hall neighbor named Bill. It's all about various religions and how they're all really versions of each other and stuff, Fradley said. So, I thought, was the White Goddess. Fradley went on. Bill explained to me how early in the book, a character at the railing of a boat tears up a letter and tosses the pieces out on the wind, which blows them away over the water. And Bill describes them like white gulls flying off into the sky. Then at the other end of the novel, on another boat, a bunch of white gulls fly away from the ship over the water. And Bill describes them as looking like pieces of a letter someone has torn up and tossed into the wind. That struck me as fascinating. I'd like to read it, I said. I'd lend it to you, Fradley said. I've started it a couple of times, and I don't think I'm going to finish it anytime soon. But Bill signed it to me, so I don't think I better let it out of the house. Oh, I said. And sure enough, on the title page was a scrawled signature and a commendment to Fradley. Next month, I brought home to my own family's apartment in Morningside Gardens my first copy of a hardcover Recognitions from one of my earliest trips to the Strand. I wish I could say I read it through immediately, but that had to wait till late winter of 1976 and the mass-market Bard book that Peter Mayer had gambled on from Avon. By then, I was 33 and a visiting Butler Chair professor at the University of Buffalo and snowed into a Buffalo motel over a 3-day blizzard. I started at page one and 3 days later finished it, as Stanley makes his way to the church with the organ he has been in search of, mistaking a men's room momentarily for a sacred chapel, the theme of the mistaken identification ringing out over the novel's landscape until the end, and his ignorance of Italian condemning him to death. He plays his composition with its grand bass passage on the organ, and the cathedral, unable to remain standing around it, collapses, killing the composer and ending the cascade of verbal magic and conceptual music that is Gaddis's extraordinary work. I'm going to read you a little of the Recognitions, followed by a letter the 26-year-old Gaddis wrote to Charles Socarides, which first puts forward his vision for the plot and development for the entire book. The scene I will read has stayed with me from that long ago defeated first reading before, 100 pages later, I simply gave up. But it was the first scene where I recognized the novel contained something specifically for me. Chapter 4 is one of the shortest in the book, and was the scene in which I realized that the novel did hold something, though I knew at 17 I was going to have to come back and do some serious digging and thinking to grasp it. After a stint in Greenwich Village, as a young writer who has friended and been befriended by the tortured painter of meticulous forgeries, Wyatt Gwyon, and his wife Esther, in an attempt to garner some real experience of the world, the young Otto has gone to Central America to live for a while on a banana plantation and work on his play, to imitate real writers, as it were, and work further on his pastiche of overheard witticisms that have impressed the young fellow in various Greenwich Village parties over the last few years, in which Gordon says one crushingly witty thing after another, and the beautiful and sophisticated Priscilla plays a straight man, scene after scene, act after act. The setting. In the dry season haze, the hills were deep blue and looked further away than the sun itself, for the sun seemed to have entered that haze, to hang between the man and the horizon where, censured and subdued, it suffered the indignity of his stare. The heat of the day was inert as the haze, which made it visible, and it only mitigated with the dissolution of the haze in darkness. Interrupting Otto's work on his play, an all but illiterate sailor, Jesse Frank, enters, shirtless, barefoot, tattooed, spitting on the floor, looking for someone to talk to. "Read me your play," he tells Otto. Otto obliges, but Jesse does not think too much of the effort. "You want something to write about?" he demands of Otto after offering himself as the topic for a good, exciting tale. "Okay, take this down. Gordon was the kind of guy who shouldered his way into a bar. He came in and got what he wanted. If anybody wanted to make trouble, no. He was a nice guy. But if anybody wanted to make trouble, you got that?" "Yes," said Otto with a pencil. "If anybody was looking for trouble..." No, that doesn't sound too good. Leave that out." He watched Otto's pencil to be sure he was marking out. "Okay, now start with this. I was around Chiliano Bay in Colombia with no money of the country, see? I had some money. I had about $100, but no money of the country, see? But I have to have a little to get around the country. I was on a boat with a contraband cargo, so I run into a chileta. You know what a chileta is?" "No, I..." "And you're not so smart, are you? Just because you went to college. It's a money changer. Guy who changes money and takes some out for himself. Okay, so a Cayuga comes out to the ship wanting to buy a cargo, but no sell. Worth too much, see? You got that?" "Yes, I..." "Okay, now where was I? A Cayuga came out to the ship." "Yeah. So this guy is only wearing dungarees, tight-fitting, see? He's well-built, wearing a pair of tight-fitting dungarees. You got that?"
"Yes."
"How did you say it?" "He was a well-built fellow wearing tight-fitting dungarees." "Okay, so he goes into town and finds a girl in a bar. She wants to go to bed with him, but he can't take no chances because of the cargo. The police see. The girl visits him at his house, but he can't take no chances. So he tells her, 'Take it easy.'" Jesse stopped and looked at Otto. "You're going to get paid for this, and I ain't going to get nothing."
"I never sold anything yet," Otto said.
"Yeah, well, you can sell this. This is what people like to read about. Where was I? Okay, so she wants to stay, but he wants everything he has in line for shark fishing. Chiliano Bay, that's the place for shark fishing. So he dives for sharks. The white ones and the nigger sharks. Those are the black ones. They don't kill the white ones, but he'll do it, see? He's not scared. He'll die for any shark, period." Otto waited. How's that? Asked the author.
Well, it isn't quite a story yet.
What do you mean it isn't a story? You think I don't know what a story is? This is what people like to read about, realism, real men doing something, not a lot of crap and fancy trimmings, you get me?
Yes, sir.
You're going to get paid for this, and I ain't going to get nothing.
Jesse returned to admiring his chest.
Otto stood and walked over to the bed. He scratched his arm to give his hand something to do.
Yeah, you're pretty all right. Where'd you get hands like that? They ain't men's hands.
They just grew, Otto started to reason, like yours did.
Like mine! Jesse made a fist as Otto sat down again.
Yeah, you gotta wise up to yourself, see?
Jesse approached with a flat bottle of the palm of his hand in the palm of his hand and stopped swaying over him. He made a motion of smashing the bottle in Otto's face and stood laughing.
I have to go to bed, Jesse.
Yeah, you have to go to bed. Look, Rabbit, I'm looking for a shack job, see?
Otto sat still.
Get me?
I get you.
Jesse stood swaying for a moment. Then he said,
I gotta go dump my bowels.
Well, I'm going to bed, said Otto. He stood stretched as though at ease, yawned a feigned yawn. Jocularly man to man, he said, good night, Jesse. I don't want to seem to throw you out.
Throw me out, why, Rabbit? You couldn't throw me. You just try. If you want to kick me, you want me to kick you from one end of this room to the other? Throw me out, Rabbit. That's a good one, said Jesse, out the door, carrying the bottle, leaving the dirty glass.
What struck me in this scene was how familiar its content was. Structurally, it is a sign of the same order of growth as the much younger Stephen Dedalus in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man undergoes, when, as a little boy going to sleep, he realizes that a rhyming quatrain recited backwards with a rhyme scheme reversed was no longer a poem. I had by now declared myself a writer and was slowly willing to declare it to others. Hell, I'd even published some novels. And already at least three times now, I had run into one Jesse Frank or another who wanted me to write his story for him and who had tried to tell me his story with no more sense of what a story was than Jesse himself. What I'd recognized in this momentary glimpse of the underside of this saraband of forgeries and attempts to create meaning that may or may not be there in imitation of a god who may or may not be there himself, and whom clearly Mr. Gaddis did not have much faith in any of the formal organizations through which he was supposed to manifest, is that the reason all art is forgery and must be borrowed is not because we take the content from others, but rather that to make it comprehensible at all, to make it a story, we must steal the substructure that makes it signify. And this is absolutely and universally inescapable. Because it had already happened to me, and happened to me repeatedly, I was pretty sure it or something very much like it had happened to Gaddis as well. And this was why I was so interested to read his 1948 letter to Charles Sacharides from the Panama Canal Zone that gives the wondering 26-year-old writer's first overall view of his theme and the structure of his extraordinary novel 7 years before it was published.
And here we have the letter. Dear Charles, first, please don't be alarmed by the weight of the correspondence which I may seem to be thrusting on you. But when you write a letter like this that I have just received, honestly, I go quite off my head with excitement. I'm fearfully nervous now. All because I have been away for 3 days on a neighboring island working frantically on this novel, which looks so bad. But here you see what you say in these letters. Most specifically, this last upset me because the pictures you draw, the facts you offer, are just at this as this novel is growing. It is a good novel, terrific. The whole thread of the story, the happenings, the franticness, the man who metaphorically sells himself to the devil, the young man hunting for father figures, chasing the older to his younger's death, and the girl who finally completely loses her identity as she who has tried to make an original myth is lost because her last witness, a fellow who takes heroin, is sent to jail. The young man, hero, the informer. Here's the frantic point, that it all happened. Not really, maybe, but with the fact in recent life and my running, it happened all the time. Every minute, the thing growing in me. I think of or remember new facts of the novel, the truth about the past, alternate title. The title is Dukedame, called Some People Who Were Naked. But this growing fiction fits so insanely well with facts of life that sometimes I cannot stand it, must burst, as I am doing here, and then I ruin it by bad writing, like trying to be clever. This perhaps because I am afraid to be sincere, but I watch myself ruin it, and then... Because when I was writing in college, I went so overboard. Now it must be reserved, understand, intimated, or bad bits of writing just run on. Look, there are few instances when we are not trying to control time, either frantically urging it on or fearfully watching its winged chariot ragging by, spattering us with the mud that we call memory. Isn't that awful? You see, it just happened, was out of my control until the sentence reached the period. To be facile can kill what must be alive. That's why I hated Wolf, that he cried out so, because my point is no crying out, no pity. We are alone, naked, and nakedness must choose between vulgarity and reason. Every one of us responsible. Still, those lines you quote, Wolf, excited me horribly. Not to have Foster's understatement, no room for Lawrence's lust, perhaps Flaubert or Gide, but I am not good enough as they. It is sickening, this killing the best love worked. A thought comes to me whenever I think of Gide and the novel. From the first time I saw it and started reading it, I thought, this is a book that I'm sure the writer wanted to call The Counterfeiters, but because of Gide beat him to it with Les Faux Manieurs, he couldn't do it. Now I should like to see you, if you could look at this thing, flatly condense part of it, the writing, exposition, God knows all this fear, but have no sympathy with it. Fools, I cannot afford to be one. As though your letter anticipated what I am putting down as fiction. I'm going to elide a paragraph on the writer's constant need for money. It is very much like every writer's constant need for money, but it ends with an apothegm. It is hell not having either the time nor the money to live. Then there is a man here with a sailboat going to Sweden, and if the novel suddenly looks too bad, I may go. He needs someone to work a very small boat, sailboat. God, the running. And I feel that running all through a book like The Recognitions. I think the reader does.
You understand it, don't you? I almost do. But if I can make a good novel, then I must keep running until I know all through me, not just as a philosophical fact, as truth, which I believe and am trying to sell, but can sit down and know without having to try to sell it, writing to everybody. Thanks. I shall write you. I do not know if Gaddis had yet met his Jesse Frank, or one of his many Jesse Franks in that landscape that the scene and the letter share, though I suspect it is impossible to be an aspiring American writer and not meet at least one such every 2 or 3 years at minimum. But Gaddis wrote the letter from the landscape in which he would stage one such meeting in chapter 4 of his incredibly rich novel. To reiterate, one of the many points so richly and beautifully suggested through the recognitions in resonantial relation to many others is that the reason all art, all true art, is forgery is not because the content is borrowed or stolen, but because the form that makes the content recognizable as art must be taken from other works, whether on purpose or inadvertently. Otherwise, like Jesse's string of pointless incidents, it would simply not be recognizable as art. Thanks.